You're listening to Red Eye on Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO 102.7 FM. Joining me in the studio this morning are Sheila Jeffries and Gunilla Ekberg to share some of their understanding of the realities and their perspectives on responses to these realities. Sheila Jeffries is a feminist author and activist in Australia. Her most recent book is titled The Industrial Vagina, The Political Economy of the Global Sex Trade. Sheila Jeffries teaches at the University of Melbourne. And Gunilla Ekberg is a feminist lawyer and activist in Sweden, and she currently is the co-executive director of the Coalition Against Trafficking in Women International. Welcome, Sheila and Gunilla.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Prostitution is not an isolated part of our socio-political world. It's linked to many things. And there was a discussion earlier at the Vancouver Art Gallery about its connections with the building of empire. I'm wondering, Sheila, if you might give us a little sense of how that connection, at least historically, has worked.
I think there's a general understanding that black slavery has been important in the construction of empires, particularly the British Empire. And there's a considerable amount of sorrow and grief now about the recognition of that role, and there's talk about reparations to make up for what was done to people in the building of that empire. Prostitution has also been important in the building of empires, and the trafficking of women into debt bondage has been crucially important in the building of empires. But the extraordinary thing is that the attitude towards it is different. Because this is not generally recognized as a form of slavery, there's no talk about reparations to those women. In fact, there's a lot of moves to make it seen as just an ordinary kind of work and helpful to development because, you know, the monies from prostitution come from an ordinary industry. To give an example of the way that it's been used, it's been recognized by scholars that prostitution has been very important to the development of Japan economically in the second half of the 19th century and to the Japanese empire from that basis. Children were, from the age of seven onwards, were either sold into the brothels or kidnapped and taken to Shanghai and Singapore, trained there, raised in prostitution, sent out then in debt bondage to Kalgoorlie in Australia to service the mining men in that area, sent to Vancouver and to many places around the Pacific Rim. And it was money from that and the services around these industries that went back to Japan. In Australia, in order for the development of the resources of Australia by the colonists, prostitution was absolutely crucial. In all of the mining centres as they developed across Australia, the assumption was, as it still is, that men cannot masturbate, but that they must have the bodies of women to put their penises into wherever they are, and if there are not their own women that they use for this purpose with them, there must be prostitution. So prostitution's been absolutely vital in the development of the mining industry through Australia. In northern Australia, as the cattle stations were set up, Aboriginal women were kidnapped onto those stations and used for these purposes and so on. So prostitution's always been there. This extreme form of abuse of women in conditions of slavery has always been there in the building of empires.
Sure. Would you like to add something?
Yeah, I'd like to add something that I think it was a great overview of the historical context. And I just want to add that this is an ongoing process. It's not something that ended. And I would like to give the Netherlands and Germany as good examples of empires that are building some of their economic power based on the trafficking of women and the prostitution of women in their legal industry. So, for example, if you look at Netherlands, they have about 60,000 to 80,000 women in prostitution. 80% comes from another country. Germany has 400,000 women in prostitution, and 90% come from another country. Of course, local women are also prostituted, and the combined income profit of this, for example, feeds the Amsterdam tax bases, where you can, if you look at the yearly budget of Amsterdam, there's about 5% in incomes from the prostitution industry alone. And I'm talking about the legal prostitution industry, not the illegal, which is usually much larger.
How large is prostitution as a business, as a commercial enterprise?
It's difficult to gauge international worth, but for particular economies, we have quite a lot of information. It's estimated worth of 8% of the GDP of China, And between 2 to 14% of the GDP of different countries in Asia, particularly Thailand, where it's extremely high. But it's getting higher and higher in other countries now. Industry reports on Australia say that it's worth $2.1 billion a year, and they encourage people to invest in it because it's legalized there and a perfectly reasonable industry. And then there are lots and lots of tie-in industries. The Scottish whiskey makes huge amounts of money in Thailand from being sold in the brothels. There's taxis, hotels, the tourism trade, there's the creation of costumes for the industry, and so on and so on. So there's massive amounts of money involved in this industry, but unfortunately it's money coming from violence and abuse.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's look a little bit more at Australia. When did the first legalization of prostitution come into effect in
my state of Victoria, which was the very first one? It was 1984 that a form of legalized brothel prostitution was introduced, and there was a big act in 1994 which extended that.
When I use the word legalization, I guess I'm just using a vocabulary. What does that kind of mean in what's legitimated?
Yes, legalization in my state means that brothels apply for licenses to conduct their trade and escort agencies apply for licenses to conduct their trade. It's not much different from decriminalization, although people try to make a distinction. Decriminalization is the idea that prostitution is just like hairdressing, so you treat it in exactly the same way. No state buys that because of the very, very serious harms involved in prostitution, particularly of public order and organized crime. So actually, there's no example of perfect decriminalization in the world, and in fact, it would be quite impossible because the harms are so very, very, very severe. So states usually do legalizing, so they try to sort of minimize the very serious harms that they know exist.
So does that mean that the purchasing, the organizing, the practicing of prostitution, all these are without legal penalty or legal prohibition?
Only if they're conducted in legal establishments. You're not supposed to run illegal brothels, but legal brothels and the legal industry comes under consumer affairs. So it's treated, in fact, as a perfectly ordinary industry in that
consumer
respect.
Consumer affairs.
Yes.
My goodness.
Right? I mean, it's actually not a completely ordinary industry. For instance, when the brothels are set up, they're supposed to be a few hundred yards from children's schools, etc. So when a ballet school was set up next to a brothel in Melbourne, the brothel went to court and said that the little girls are sitting on the steps and laughing at the men, and it has to move, and the ballet school had to move. And that shows what an industry does when it comes into a city, the way it actually affects the whole social fabric of that city and starts to command what can happen around it.
Was there any opposition to this process of legalization?
There was very little, I'm afraid, at the time. Feminists all seemed to think it was a good idea because they were buying the idea that women would actually be safer in those brothels. That's not the case because, for a start, there's only a tiny portion of the industry that's in the brothels. 400 brothels are estimated to be illegal, 100 legal. There's a massive illegal sector in every way. Street prostitution is much huger than it was before. So only a small number of women are in it. Escort prostitution, even though it's legal, is hugely unsafe because women are just sent out to any old place to be prostituted all on their own with men. In the legal brothels, we know that it's still an extremely painful and abusive industry. For instance, the occupational health and safety codes that states set up when they legalize suggest in my state, for instance, on the community health website, which is a government website, that women should be careful when using local anesthetic in the vagina because it can cover up more serious harms. So the state is actually regulating the violence of the industry. It gives lots of advice, such as when a woman is approaching a house, she should see how many cars and lights are on because she's going to be gang raped. Otherwise, she has to leave her belongings by the door so she doesn't have to run naked out of the house. So the state becomes involved in regulating what it absolutely knows is violence and absolutely not an industry like hairdressing.
I understand as well that the state provides racial profiling or legitimates racial profiling for purchasers of prostitution.
That's right. In Queensland, the Prostitution Licensing Authority website has a specific page called Approved Words to be Used in Advertising, Approved Words and Phrases, and they include Japanese, Asian, and lots of racially specific terms. Originally, they hadn't wanted to include that, but then they were persuaded by prostitutes' rights organizations they had to include racially specific terms, because if the men found a woman who was of the wrong skin color when they arrived, they would beat her up. And also, women had to be advertised racially in order to get that particular sector of market for the women. So what states end up doing is regulating and selling the bodies of sexed and raced women. Racism is endemic to and fundamental to that industry, as is very clear if you look at the websites of any of the brothels and the strip clubs where women are racially sold, or the advertisements in the newspapers. There is no other occupation in which people are actually sold by race for the use of the internal parts of their bodies.
I wanted to go back to a comment you made about there being little opposition. And Gunilla, I have an impression that in the 20th century, liberal progressive movements and certainly radical progressive movements worked for the abolition of prostitution. I don't know if that is correct impression, and if it is, isn't, please, you know, explain that. But if it is, what's been the change?
Well, I would say in some areas of the world, the women's and the feminist movement and other human rights organizations and movements is supporting an abolition of prostitution and trafficking, which is, of course, in line with the international human rights instruments, which puts the bodily integrity and the dignity of the human person central to the human rights of both men and women. Unfortunately, there are also groups that call themselves feminists, although I would argue that they're not, because you cannot be a feminist and actually not have an analysis of violence, male violence against women, or not having an understanding of power differences between men and women in this context, who argue that prostitution is sex work, which, of course, we who work on this are opposed to, and seeing something that's one of the most serious and extreme forms of violence repainted as something that would be benign and good to women, which we know both from experience of women who speak out who have been in prostitution, but also by the very fact of the profit making and keeping women in unsafe conditions.
Let's turn then to Sweden, where you live now. It took an opposite direction to what Sheila's outlined for Australia.
Yes.
What is the legal situation in Sweden?
Since January 1st, 1999, we have a specific legislation that criminalizes those who purchase somebody for the prostitution purposes, which mainly is, of course, men who are buying women, but also a law that covers any form of purchase in any venue, so indoors, outdoors, escort services, whatever form the prostitution activities take. The law is, there is a possibility of prosecuting and sentencing those who purchase to a fine, which is a day fine, which is a typical construct of the legal system in Scandinavia, which means that if you are apprehended under this law and either plead guilty or convicted, you pay a fine on the percentage of your income. So if you make a lot of money, you pay a very large fine, and if you make less money, you pay a lower fine. And then you can be convicted up to 6 months in prison.
And this law was brought in with what kind of support from the political sphere, the popular sphere, the social movement?
Well, it's the interesting thing with our legislation is that it is standing on a pure feminist basis. It was initiated by the Swedish feminist movement back in the 70s, where we had, as so many other countries, consciousness-raising groups where we talked about the violence committed to women and what we could politically do to ameliorate the situation. And there were women, of course, who had been in prostitution, who participated in the groups and who were strongly in favor of not separating out prostitution from other forms of male violence. So we started very early to pressure politicians and also go out in the media and pointing out that if we want to be consistent with our other gender equality policies in the country, we can't exclude women who are being violated through prostitution by men who purchase them. And we also wanted to point to the real perpetrator in prostitution, the one who is actually committing the prostitution act, meaning using women, paying and exploiting sexually, physically, harassing, etc., and that they should be seen as the perpetrator and be criminalized, not the women. And I want to point that out, and I want to underline that our system clearly recognizes that those who are in prostitution are victims of a form of violence and should then be have a right to services to get out of prostitution, not harm reduction services. We do not have them. We don't believe in them. It has to be services that has the vision that women can live, or young men can live, in a world where they're not violence is not perpetrated against them.
So the law vis-a-vis prostitution was part of a campaign against violence on women particularly, which raises the whole question. Many people do not perceive what is the violent character of prostitution. And I'm wondering if both of you could comment a bit on that dimension.
Yes, there are two kinds of violence involved with prostitution. They're what I call paid-for violence and unpaid-for violence. The unpaid-for violence are all the rapes and beatings that women endure who are prostituted by clients, by pimps, and so on, and they're very, very severe. The paid-for violence is the everyday acts of prostitution, of the anus, because anal sex is absolutely required now in prostitution, and it's incredibly painful. If you read the descriptions of women being sort of battered by penises with their legs up against a wall with pain like a red hot poker straight through the center of their bodies and so on. That's a very fundamental act. Pain in the vagina as well. The women are struggling all the time to keep the men's hands off parts of their bodies that they don't want them on. So it's constant sexual harassment, which they're fighting all the time and struggling to survive whilst not letting the penis go down. If the penis goes down, they are not going to get their money. So in one of the health and safety codes, it says, you know, you're sore from three or four clients and another man comes in and he grabs for your crotch. You don't want to upset him, but it would be too painful, so you turn towards him offering a breast instead. Of course, you don't want your breast touched, but it would be better than anything else. It also says if the man's becoming violent, you don't want to lose your booking, but you must run out because the next day, if you have bruises, you won't be able to work. And that covers both the unpaid violence and the paid violence in that one code. And the codes which are drawn up by the prostitutes' rights organisation show exactly what they understand to be the basic problems in prostitution. So it's not as if feminists are exaggerating or making something up here.
No, just as you say, this violence is not unknown, but it's those who defend prostitution as a good form for especially marginalized poor women to make money care to not mention the violence that is committed daily towards women. And as Sheila so well talks about, the actual Prostitution Act. I also think we need to talk about prostitution in a structural, as a violation of all women in a society, because if you marginalize one subclass of women and say they are to be available for the men in that society to be purchased and sexually exploited, that of course has an effect on all of society, because if you normalize the idea of women as sexual objects for men in this context, that is going to have dire consequences for every one of us. And we can see that in the countries where prostitution has been normalized, like in the Netherlands and Germany, for example, where other measures, what we would call feminist political policy and legal measures, are very little developed. Women, for example, in Germany are still taxed with their husbands, which is something it's not done in any other country. Old traditional way of keeping women bound to their husbands. So there's all kinds of examples of how you limit women's possibility and gender equality if you have prostitution, apart from the actual violence directed to the woman in prostitution.
What have been the changes that have come about in Sweden as a result of the laws making prostitution a form of violence and therefore criminalizing the purchasing of women?
First of all, I want to say that it's not enough just to have this legislation. You have to have underlying principles that understand the reality of prostitution, that informs not just this law, but informs anything you do on prostitution. So, for example, in our case, we have gender equality as a basic underlying principle, that all men and women, boys and girls in the country should have the possibility of having the same rights and possibilities to live. And so that has to inform any political area. So, for example, first of all, you need to, I think that what the law did is it changed a culture of prostitution into a culture of understanding that prostitution is a form of violence. But you also have to look at all other areas, for example, development aid. When you give money from a country like Canada, give a lot of money in development aid, who do you give the money to? Do you give it to organizations that are actually assisting women getting out of prostitution? Or are you supporting organizations that are lobbying for the legalization of the prostitution industry in that country? So you need to go through and look at all of those things. So that's like the basis. And of course, when you put this law into place, it has to be coupled with money to organizations, good organizations, preferably organizations that have worked on other forms of male violence before, so that women can, or young men can, exit prostitution, not just short term, but actually long term programs. You need to educate the police so that they don't treat the women in prostitution as they may have done before. And Canada is a good example because women are criminalized here, which has also created a lot of abuse against women in prostitution. You have to ensure that the police understand not just the laws, but the principles. You have to educate those who work with these issues to treat women well. And you have to educate them also to see the men who purchase as the perpetrators, because there is a solidarity between male police officers and buyers. And we saw that very clearly when the law came into place the first year. We had several occasions of police officers, male police officers, I should say, suggesting to the buyers who were apprehended that maybe they had another address where they could send a notice of a crime committed so that the wife wouldn't find out. Something that, of course, we had to discuss and say that this is unacceptable and they're not going to be treated any differently than anybody else. You also, of course, can also have to focus on the pimps. So, and have good anti-brothel legislation or procuring legislation, and you have to have good legislation that cover national and transborder trafficking of women into sexual exploitation.
Has the change in Sweden influenced other countries to move in a similar direction?
Yes, because what we can see, there's been some really good benefit from this law in Sweden that has influenced others. And one is, of course, that the law functions basically as a barrier for traffickers to establish themselves in Sweden, or as we were translated in, organized crime to establish themselves in Sweden. We don't have the big organized crime groups operating in Sweden, unlike the countries around us. And I think that's important
and
to point out.
Like Australia.
Like Australia, which there's a huge involvement. Like Canada, where there's a huge involvement of organized crime in the prostitution industry. So that's one effect. But we've also seen, and latest research tells us, of the normative effects of this legislation, that before the law came into place 10 years ago, it was about 13.6% of Swedish men over 18 who had once or more purchased somebody for prostitution purposes. And the research that came out on the 16th of October this year says clearly that it's gone down to 8%. So we also can see a normative swing where men actually see that this is not worth it. They will not continue to do this. And then there's, of course, other effects also, because you can see in our society, yes, we still have prostitution because you don't change the world in 10 years, but you actually head in a direction that could lead to change. And that's the difference between our policies and those who claim that prostitution should be industrialized, because we at least we have a political vision that we can abolish this. They just stay and stamp and you know, we're going to in some way or another minimize the harm. So what we can see now, there's many countries who are pondering how they're going to deal with prostitution and trafficking. The measures that they have done have not been particularly successful. The trafficking is going up in most countries in Europe, and in other countries outside of Europe it is increasing by the minute, because there's rarely much done. And they turn to Sweden and they say, well, this seems to be working. Maybe we should start thinking about this. And Norway, I think, is the best example here, because Norway decided this fall, after 10 years of contemplation, watching what was going on in Sweden, Parliament did pass a similar legislation that's actually coming into force on our 10-year anniversary, 1st of January 2009. And what's even more interesting with the Norwegian legislation is that they have looked at ours and they have ameliorated it. They have added things to it. So they have now also the possibility of criminalizing those men who travel, the Norwegian residents or citizens who travel to other countries and purchase women without the need of having the same legislation in that country. That's a great amelioration. They also don't talk about the criminalization of the purchase of sexual services. They talk about the purchase of a sexual act, which I think is much more appropriate. So it's going to be very interesting. It'll come into force, as I said, on 1st of January. And now we can collaborate. The police already collaborates, but now it's going to be so much easier. And their law is also combined with money to exit services, by the way.
You had raised the issue, maybe we'll close with a further comment on this from Sheila, of an alternate perspective which advocates what is called harm reduction, some amelioration of the health conditions for people who are in prostitution, alleged safety improvements, etc. Why do you find that an uncompelling approach?
It's profoundly pessimistic. It is founded on the idea that men will always prostitute women, that it's some kind of biological and inevitable part of their being instead of a socially constructed behaviour. It keeps women in prostitution by putting sticking plasters on the most serious wounds that they are experiencing as they go through. In my country, there are no exit programmes provided by the state. Indeed, they would say, you know, what's the difference? Prostitution, hairdressing doesn't have exit programmes. Why would you need exit programs from prostitution? But they do put in these programs to put in the sticking plasters. So basically, it's when the state provides harm reduction, it's keeping prostitution going for its male citizens. It's patching up the women and turning them out again so that the men have sexual access. Nothing is done about the men. Now, we don't get anywhere near women's equality until we start recognizing that men can change their behavior, that it's possible to educate and change the way they behave towards women and bring prostitution to an end.
Well, thank you both very much for joining me this morning and being on our program. I've been speaking with Sheila Jeffries. She's a feminist author and activist living in Australia, and with Gunilla Ekberg, who's a feminist lawyer and activist living in Sweden.